over to our host, Josephine Jacobs. Joe, can I turn things over to you?
Sounds great. Thanks so much, Rob.
Thank you.
And hello, everyone, and thank you very much for joining today's seminar. We're very excited to have Dr. Alex Dopp with us today as part of HERC's Health Economics Seminar Series. Dr. Dopp is a behavioral and social scientist at RAND and a professor of policy analysis at Party RAND Graduate School. He's an implementation scientist and child clinical psychologist who studies the use of research evidence and related policy implications for improving youth mental health and substance use services. He has dual expertise in behavioral health services and economic evaluation. So that allows him to conduct research on upstream influences like financing strategies and downstream outcomes like economic impact. We're very much looking forward to learning more about Dr. Dopp's research today. So without further ado, I will hand things over to you.
Sounds good. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, great to be with you today. I've attended many of these presentations on the audience side over the years, so it's exciting and fun for me, and I'm honored to be here and share some work in this space that I've been doing in behavioral health. As Joe mentioned, I'm a child clinical psychologist by training, and I'm here on behalf of a number of different teams, and will do my best to represent all of the work that we've been doing, and also want to recognize multiple institutes at NIDA, at NIH for funding this work. So I'm going to give a little background here first about what I mean when I talk about financing strategies, what it means to have strategies for financing implementation and sustainment, and what that looks like in behavioral health specifically, since that's my primary area of expertise. And then I will walk you through two different studies that I have been leading, one that is looking at the outcomes of different types of financing strategies, and the other which developed a tool to help service organizations engage in tailored selection of financing strategies to promote sustainment. And then I have some thoughts about where this work is continuing to go and what we're seeing as our next steps and future directions, but really looking forward to thoughts and questions from the audience as well, because that always gives us great ideas for where else we should be taking this work. So just to start, I imagine that this is probably familiar territory for most folks who work in any way related to evidence-based practices or translation of research evidence into practice. But just to start us off on the same page, it's important to recognize that evidence-based practices do tend to be complex and costly, especially when you're comparing them to usual services that you're trying to improve upon. Evidence-based practices are often designed and tested without, if I were going to edit my own slide, I would say without fully considering real-world implementation. And so when we go to try to implement, scale up, sustain these practices, there's a number of different costs that end up becoming incurred that weren't necessarily thought through ahead of time. And this doesn't only include use of the practice itself, like service delivery, but all of the other implementation and sustainment activities, things like training, quality assurance, care coordination. There might be specialized materials or supplies that you need to use this practice. And all of these represent real costs and real challenges for service organizations and providers and systems, especially since this is usually operating, certainly here in the United States and certainly in behavioral health, with limited and fragmented funding. So that becomes a major challenge for sustainment, because it's not just securing the funds, but also figuring out which types of resource needs and which costs can come from a given funding source in order to fully cover your implementation and sustainment activities. So recognizing that challenge and that reality really motivated me as someone who has background in this area and has delivered evidence-based practices myself to think about what can we do to make it easier to invest in implementation and sustainment. And that drew my interest to studying financing strategies. And this is something that I think of as a subset of implementation strategies that help organizations and systems secure financial resources. So that's really the common thread for anything that you'll hear me refer to as a financing strategy. And this can be for both initial evidence-based practice implementation, as well as the long-term sustainment of those practices. And I've listed just a few examples here. There's many different ways. It's more about the function of helping to support implementation and or sustainment, and really thinking about all of those costs. Again, not just service delivery, that would make me call something a financing strategy and say it's part of that universe of implementation strategies. And we really have very limited research-based guidance for folks like service administrators, policymakers, people who develop and disseminate EBPs, on how they could actually make use of financing strategies or develop new financing strategies to optimize how we're investing in the use of evidence-based practices. So I have a reference slide at the end of this deck, so you can download the deck and that will point you to the references that I'll talk about today. The first way that I got into this work is taking stock of what we already knew. And so I led a scoping review, which was published in 2020, of financing strategies that had been documented in behavioral health literature. And we identified 23, so that list on the previous page is just a subset of the categories that we identified and specified through the scoping review. Mental health and child welfare were the most commonly studied settings, so that was one of the things we looked at, is where are these strategies being used? Where do we know more or less about how investment in EBPs is working right now? And the other thing that I will note is that everything we found in this scoping review, which was quite broad, you know, compared to something like a systematic review, we really looked at a wide variety of documents, not just empirical research studies. But we weren't able to find anything that was examining specific implementation or service outcomes that came out of the use of a financing strategy. It was all descriptive studies that were identifying and just providing information about which financing strategies had been used, but nothing to really tell us about if the strategies were working well to support implementation and sustainment and downstream outcomes from that. That compilation has now been updated in 2023. Madison North at the University of Oklahoma led the publication of the updated compilation, and that update came from representatives of the youth mental health systems who had reviewed and given us feedback on the way that we had defined those strategies in the scoping review. We made a lot of changes, but I will say that they were all really sort of wording changes, what you would call a surface level modification. So that happened with over half, but we didn't have any major addition, splitting, lumping, cutting, anything like that. We also got a lot of information from the study about what these folks thought about the use of these strategies in practice. And except for a subset of highly relevant strategies, most of the strategies that we identified from the literature, folks had pretty limited familiarity with. And this included not only people who worked at service organizations, but also people who worked in evidence-based practice dissemination roles at purveyor or intermediary organizations, and people who worked in youth mental health funding organizations. So across the board, there were a number of strategies where the familiarity with it was pretty low. And even for those strategies that people saw as the most relevant and most familiar, the ratings were kind of mixed. You know, there was certainly room for improvement in terms of how available those strategies were, how feasible it was to actually use them to secure funding, and how effective they were for sustaining evidence-based practices, getting back to those fragmentation issues that I was mentioning earlier. And of course, this is all happening in a broader context that we're not specifically studying, but it impacts everything we do, that US policy has really chronically underinvested in behavioral health service delivery, commensurate with the need. And so by extension, if we're not even paying for just delivering the services, then certainly that means that there's not much of a margin left over to pay for any other implementation or sustainment activities. And so this is an equity issue on its face, just in terms of parity for people who have behavioral health disorders. But I've also seen the ways that implementation work is undervalued and often performed by people because they're motivated to make a difference in their community. And it's being done, frankly, a lot of times as uncompensated extra labor with people's own time, own effort, own resources. So that's something I'm concerned about, because I think implementation and sustainment is really important to do in an intentional way, and we should value that. And how we fund things is an expression of our values. So that's why I think of this as an equity consideration, and just wanted to say that up front. So now that I've given that background, I'll walk through two studies here, like I mentioned. First, I'm gonna talk about a study that looks at financing strategy outcomes, and specifically the implementation outcome that we have examined so far in this work is reach. So I will define exactly what that looked like. The financing strategy that we're looking at are two different types of federal grants. And the EBP that we're looking at is a youth substance use EBP called the Adolescent Community Reinforcement Approach. I won't spend a lot of time on this or the other EBPs that I'll talk about later, not because I think it's unimportant, but just because they are being used as examples, and a lot of the implications are much broader. But briefly, if you're not familiar, we chose to study ACRA because it is a nice exemplar of a lot of the best practices that you would want to see in an effective youth substance use treatment. And it is a primarily individual treatment. You can use it with youth up to age 25, but there are mechanisms for involving families and caregivers. And it's really quite a flexible treatment model. So you can use it in a lot of different settings and delivery modes and sort of meet the client where they're at in terms of how you're approaching use of the procedures and applying the overall principles that you get trained in as an ACRA provider. The grants that we are interested in were part of a federal implementation effort to scale up ACRA across the United States, led by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, specifically the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, or CSAT. And they had different cohorts of grants that they funded. It wasn't always a requirement to implement ACRA, but ACRA was a commonly implemented model through these grants. And the earlier cohorts went directly to treatment organizations. So we call those organization-focused grants. So an individual provider organization applied to get money to implement and start delivering ACRA as part of their services. In 2012, SAMHSA changed this grant mechanism and started instead awarding grants to state SUD service agencies. Each state has one single state agency for substance use services. And they would receive these grants with the expectation that they would set up infrastructure to support implementation and sustainment of the EBP, as well as work with individual treatment organizations to do the same implementation activities that they would have done with an organization-focused grant. So the hope was to enhance reach and sustainability with that state infrastructure in those newer grant cohorts. So this is an overview of the whole study that we're in the middle of right now. So year three of the NIDA grant that I am leading, listed at the bottom there, is wrapping up now. And so what we're doing is comparing the organization-focused grants and the state-focused grants. The organization-focused grants, we already have data on them up to 5 years post the grant ending through a grant that was led by my colleague, Sarah Hunter. And so we're building on that by collecting data from the state-focused grants. And today, I'm going to focus on the implementation phase because of those are the outcomes that I can share with you right now. And we're looking at the reach rate, which is defined as provider certification in ACRA. Did that differ by grant type? And what are factors that influenced it? And the two factors that you see listed here are things that we put in our proposal to NIDA that we wanted to specifically look at, but I will spoil this right now and say that for a lot of reasons that you can read about in our paper, these specific ones didn't really pan out. So I'm going to talk about the second question more so from our qualitative data and not this type of model that you're seeing here. And the sustainment data are to come, but I will not talk about those today. Just to give you a sense of what these outcomes were, how we operationalized them, everyone who receives training in ACRA goes through a 3-day initial training process. And then from that, there's a number of different certifications that you can receive. For a clinician, over about a 1-year period after that training, you're going to be working towards first level certification, which is the only certification that's required for independent delivery of ACRA. And it involves passing 9 core procedures or discrete clinical activities through a fidelity review that is done by Chestnut Health Systems, the developers of ACRA, or their designees. You can go on after first level to complete full certification if you pass all of the procedures. And there's this transition age youth certification that is an add-on. If you do 2 additional TAY-specific procedures, you can get TAY first level or full. And then finally, there's a separate track for supervisors to get fidelity review around ACRA supervision activities that they are doing as the supervisor. And if they pass all of those, then they are a certified supervisor. Part of being a certified supervisor means that you can train other people in ACRA. So we looked at this comparison using data that Chestnut was able to provide to us of their certification records. And so for that first question about just was there a difference in certification outcomes, you can see here that a key difference was the NE and the first level. We found a significant difference there that a greater percentage of trained providers were certified under the organization-focused grants compared to the state-focused grants. And you can see up along the top there the number of organizations and states that are represented in each of these samples. I will say because of the scale of the state-focused grants, they actually did train a lot more organizations. So we picked a random subset to look at data from and also who we had the capacity to interview so that we could directly compare them to the organization focused grants. And so we found in this direct comparison that a much higher percentage of trained providers received any certification and that first level certification. we didn't find a difference for full or for supervisor. And the TAY sites, unfortunately, there just weren't enough sites that did that training. So we couldn't do statistical tests to compare them. So really, we saw this, you know, being a difference in any that was driven by the difference at the first level. I will say, again, in the publication, there's a lot of detail about the ways that we tried to test and break this model, because this is, of course, a non-randomized design. We didn't have any say in who received a state-focused grant versus an organization-focused grant, and it certainly wasn't random. So just one example of a type of test that we did is that for state-focused grants, there was a difference between initial sites that were often called demonstration sites that worked really closely with the state when they started their grant. These often functioned very similarly to an organization-focused grantee. And then there was also more sort of diffuse implementation to other providers in the state. And when we looked at those two subsets of state-focused grantees separately, the demonstration sites were not statistically different from the organization-focused grantees. So it wasn't just that there was a difference in how, you know, who was participating in SAMHSA grants across these different cohorts. There was something about the function of the financing strategy, how it was specified, and how resources were specifically getting directed to the implementers, which are the treatment organization, really seemed to make a difference. Unfortunately, the state level activities did not translate into higher reach the way that we would have hoped. So to give some more insight into those findings, we turned to the interviews that we had conducted with providers and state administrators. These were completed, depending on when their grant ended, anywhere from 0 to 4 years post-grant. For the provider interviews, we were able to reach almost all of those 82 organizations that I mentioned on the previous slide. We were always trying to speak to a clinician and a supervisor, ended up with 1 to 2 representatives per organization, and you can see the split there of different roles. And for state administrator interviews, we were able to speak with someone who was a representative of all 18 states in the state administrator interviews in the state focus sample. The state administrator role wasn't relevant for the organization focused grantees. So we coded these interview responses using conventional content analysis qualitative methods to identify common barriers and facilitators to implementing ACRA. So what I'm talking about now really focuses on that initial implementation period, with reach being the outcome at the end of the grant period. We did talk about sustainment as well, but those responses are distinguished in terms of how they're coded. And the providers also completed surveys. Again, we didn't find any predictors there, and we talk about this more in the paper, but for time considerations, I'm not going to get into it as much today, and I'll just focus on those barriers and facilitators that we identified. And I will mention, too, the qualitative data from the organization-focused grantees had already been analyzed and published as part of the previous grant, and we incorporated that and sort of did some comparisons between the two samples to try to drill down to what those key barriers and facilitators were that really distinguished the experience of state-focused versus organization-focused grantees on average. So with the state-focused grantees, we heard a lot more about challenges with lack of fit, complex dynamics with state leadership support. Sometimes state leadership support did come up as a facilitator. So even though it was a complex process, when it worked well and state leadership was able to be effective, it really was seen as a benefit. That just didn't always pan out. People did talk about some more recent shifting community priorities about adolescent substance use that did relate to things like changing legalization status of cannabis, for example. And people did talk about the benefits of having the state organizing the funding and the training. So having some centralization for those things were seen as positive, just maybe not sufficient to get high reach levels. In the organization-focused grantees, in contrast, you saw more strength in strategic planning. Really, I would say more buy-in from these organizations because they were the ones who actively sought the funding in the first place. So there were also differences in the way that SAMHSA interacted with them because they were the direct SAMHSA grantee. So people described that federal support that came from SAMHSA, from CSAT, as being really intensive, but also sometimes so intensive that it was burdensome. So another one that was sort of mixed there. But these were some key things that stood out for us as differences between the groups from those interviews. So this is a quote from a state-focused grantee provider talking about some of those fit issues. And again, this is just one example, but these types of fit issues we saw coming up more often when states tried to cast a wider net in terms of who they got to implement ACRA. And then here's a quote from an organization-focused grantee provider talking about some of the strategic planning that they did. And in this case, it was actually about securing funding, securing local financing strategies, and advocating to be able to continue to deliver that model when the CSAP funding ended. So I want to make sure I have enough time to talk about the other study and take people's questions. So I will just say that if you are interested in this and you want to know more, it is published, and this is on the reference slide, so you can find this. All this work is open access, so you should be able to download it from anywhere and get more of those details, and certainly happy to go back to this if there are more questions. But to try to make sure I end with plenty of time, I think I'll just go straight through and hold questions until the end. And now I'll turn to talking about tailored selection of financing strategies. So before we were talking about, okay, we have these two really clearly defined financing strategies. They're different types of grants. We're going to look at their outcomes. Now we're talking more, less researcher hat on, more practical practitioner or policymaker hat on. How do you make sense of this whole universe of financing strategies that are already available, that we've already heard, are not necessarily perfect on their own? How do you put it all together into something that can create a sustainment plan? And so this project, that was our goal, was to develop a strategic planning tool. This was an R21 funded by NIMH, and the aims, we did have two aims, but you can see from the arrows here that they were really closely related. We were developing the tool for strategic planning, and we were evaluating its preliminary impact at the same time. And I would say we were really co-designing this tool with the service agencies and also with those other groups I mentioned before, who are all part of the youth mental health services ecosystem. To make sure that this is something that they would actually find useful and usable in their work. So the development and the evaluation were feeding off of each other for the entire 3 years that we did this project, if you include the no-cost extension. So this is published as well. Another link there for you. The tool is called the fiscal mapping process, and you can see from the graphic here that there are a set of steps here that underlie the tool. The tool itself is based in Excel, but really what it's doing is walking you through completion of these five steps and providing structure and resources to help you successfully and fully complete them. And when I say you, I really mean representatives of a service organization. So the first step is to take stock of all of the resources that are needed to sustain the EBP. You're really sort of producing a laundry list here, but then in step two, it has you do the strategic planning part by turning that list into some objectives. What resources do we need to obtain to maximize our chance of sustainment? Step three is the last sort of brainstorming step, where now you're thinking about where are all the financing strategies that we could use to meet those objectives from that universe of 23 strategies that I talked about earlier, or anything else that the folks might already be familiar with. And then in step four, you're putting all of that together and you're looking at how do the financing strategies map onto my objectives. How close are we to meeting those objectives? Where are the gaps? Where do we need to change our strategy or find new sources of funding to make this work? And recognizing that a lot of this work is often long-term and incremental. So having a plan for what are our next steps? What are the biggest challenges we anticipate in the future? When and how are we going to revisit this to move it forward? Step five, really. Ensures that those pieces are thought about as well. And I will say we adapted these steps from, if you're familiar with intervention mapping, or also its application for implementation research, which is implementation mapping. That's where these steps got adapted from. So the pilot testing process itself was 12 months, and we had 48 participants from those roles in youth mental health services that I already mentioned. So service organizations, EBP intermediaries, and funding organizations. Once they enrolled, the service organizations participated in an initial training and monthly brief coaching meetings with fiscal mapping. Either myself or my colleague, Mary Lou Gilbert, did all of that training and coaching. We were updating the model as we went along. There was a big upgrade with version 2 that happened about 6 months in, and then we made more changes at the end. So the final version online is actually something like version 4, but in terms of the evaluation, versions 1 and 2 are the ones that people in the pilot had the most experience with. And then everybody, all three participant types, completed surveys and focus groups along the way. The service organizations also provided documents to us about their decision-making, which included completed fiscal maps if they wanted to share that. And at the end, we brought everybody together to talk about their perspective on where this tool could live in the real world outside of this pilot test going forward. And I should say we had 10 youth mental health service organizations that were doing the training and coaching and pilot testing there. The treatments that we looked at were parent-child interaction therapy for youth behavior problems and trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, which is for child and adolescent traumatic stress. And you can see some similarities and differences here. You know, they're both relatively well-specified interventions, big behavioral or cognitive behavioral piece to them, but also some big differences. TFCBT is much more individual. PCIT, there's a unique setup that you need to do this direct coaching of the parent using a one-way mirror, because it's really meant for these younger kids, and the caregiver is sort of the primary interventionist and you're coaching them. So again, just we wanted to have some variety in what people were using the fiscal mapping tool on, so that we could start to get a sense of generalizability beyond a single treatment model. So we did our evaluation, and this is the only one that's not available yet. It is in press now, so I did still put it in the reference list, but you'll probably have to wait a little while before you can get all the details on how we did these comparative case study methods. But what I really want you to know today, since I don't have a lot of time to talk about this, is that each organization that pilot tested fiscal mapping, plus any of those folks in the other roles that were their partners, that counts as one case. So we had 10 cases, and we pulled together all the data from each case using templates, which are going to be part of the supplemental materials of the publication. So you can see exactly how we did it. And then we compared and contrasted across the 10 cases to really build our explanatory power for understanding what the impact of fiscal mapping was. I don't expect you to understand that, but this is just to give you a flavor for the level of detail that we give you in the paper about all the different characteristics. And we really tried to have as much diversity as possible in terms of things like what type of organization, again, the mix of EVPs. You can see information about what roles from the organization participated in fiscal mapping and how much coaching they did. And we have lots of other information about their EVP programs and the clients that they were serving and things like that. So all of that factored into the comparing and contrasting that we did. I will go through these because I'm keeping an eye on the time and I have a tendency to do this is just go on and on because I'm so excited about this work, but I don't want to shortchange time for questions. So I probably will go through this a little bit faster than is ideal, and I can always go back to it if this is where people want to focus their time during the questions. But the first thing we looked at was the process evaluation. So what seemed to be the most important in the process of using this tool? And so it really helped us build our use case for understanding what is the scenario with having a full EBP program that has financial sustainment needs. That's where we landed for when people said it was useful to use an intensive planning process like this. And they also identified for us, these are those three roles that it seems critical to have collaboration from all of them. They're not all necessarily have to be three people. It depends on the structure of the organization. But having those three roles represented was really crucial. People also found the coaching really valuable, but also difficult to prioritize on top of everything else that we were doing. So a lot of those discussions we had around what are the next steps for fiscal mapping, we're trying to figure out where is a place where this could get naturally introduced and people could naturally get coached in how to do it. And people did talk about how challenging it was to bring funders into the conversation. They really wanted to. They saw that it's beneficial. But even in a year of coaching, they often felt like, they still weren't quite ready to have those conversations with funders. So this is a quote from a financial manager just talking about how their thinking changed around from we're sustaining this discrete practice to we're committed to having a program for this EBP. And that means that we as an organization really think about it as a cohesive whole instead of just sort of a tool in the therapist's tool belt, which is what they were thinking, how they were thinking about the EBP before. For outcomes, we did find that organizations that engaged with the fiscal mapping process, which not everybody did, some people did drop out of coaching, they stopped using the tool, but those that engage did consistently report increased ability to strategically plan for financial sustainment. And those were really two key capacities that we were looking to improve with this tool. And that also was consistently related to increases in the extent and intention to continue sustaining the ABP. So again, not everybody improved in these outcomes, but whenever they did, it was following these improvements in strategic planning. But that said, like I've mentioned several times, people really saw this as an incremental process and felt like a single year wasn't long enough to really see the seeds that they were planting in that first year bear fruit necessarily. So here's a quote from a clinical manager just talking about how they used the fiscal mapping process to change the way they were talking about how to strategically plan. And in this organization's case, they really changed things like, okay, we're gonna write new line items and, really specify things in our grant proposals to help make our program more sustainable. Last slide on findings here, and then I will move towards wrapping things up. So, there were a lot of contextual influences that people told us about throughout the process in coaching and focus groups, things like that. So Certainly, the system capacities and what funding sources were available were a huge constraint, and the tool doesn't magically make new funding sources appear. So that was really a challenge for some folks. Organizational leadership, the extent to which they were bought into this process and saw it as aligned with their priorities for the EBP, for how the people who were wanting to do fiscal mapping should be spending their time, was another major constraint. A lot of turnover. If you work with anyone in behavioral health settings, you're probably encountering this on a regular basis. And this was both threatening the use of the EBP itself, and it was also creating needs where people who wanted to focus on fiscal mapping were getting pulled into these service areas to cover, to hire, to solve crises. And sometimes we had turnover of people on the fiscal mapping team too, which was obviously challenging for continuity. And, you know, we were pretty concerned to see that organizations that were prioritizing populations that experienced mental health inequities, for example, based on race, based on rurality, you know, that there were more challenges there, and we didn't do a good enough job of addressing that because they were less likely to be successful with the tool. And on a positive note, people did view this process as likely to generalize across a variety of EBPs. They did not see it as specific to PCIT or TFCBT at all. And this is a quote just illustrating that idea behind the inequities and how shifting to other funding sources could help them to fill their gaps. But this senior leader felt like it was taking us away from our mission of who we're trying to serve if we deprioritize patients with Medicaid and prioritize patients with private insurance instead. So I'm going to end with these key takeaways here. I have a couple more slides, but I don't want to shortchange people on questions and discussion. So I'm just going to tell you one more time what I told you. And then probably based on the questions, it will prompt me to talk about some of our next steps. But hopefully what you heard from me today is that financing strategies are important, but we still don't really understand that much about how they work in terms of investing in EBP implementation and sustainment. So there's a lot of work we can do here. We do know now from the work that my team has done that financing strategy specifications can have important impacts on EBP implementation outcomes, like we saw with ACRA REACH. And we know that we can help treatment organizations use strategic planning tools like the fiscal mapping process to navigate the challenging environments that they encounter for financial sustainment. And we identified room for improvement there, and that's what we're working on now. Hopefully you share our perspective that there's a lot of promise in what we're seeing so far from these studies. So I want to stop there and see, Rob, are there questions that I should attend to?
Not just yet. Maybe we can give people a few minutes to come in with any questions.
I will finish my slides then. There's only a couple left. So then I will come back to sitting in silence, which I can do since I was a therapist in a former life. And see what else people would like to hear. But since we don't have any questions yet, I will just go through these final slides really quickly. So in terms of future directions, like I mentioned, we really want to look at ACRA sustainment trajectories and outcomes from those CSAT grants. You know, we're concerned now about the outcomes of the state-focused grants just based on the lower reach rates. But we're also trying to identify the conditions under which those state-focused grants are maybe a more effective strategy and using more case study methods there. So there's a lot more that we can unpack in the next few years of that grant. We're also looking at ways that we can integrate fiscal mapping into existing EBP training initiatives, implementation out in the wild. So things like learning collaboratives, which we both think would increase the scalability and sustainability of the tool itself and also give us opportunities for larger scale evaluation of its impact. And my hope is to really grow the variety of interdisciplinary and community engaged teams that are doing this type of work, whether it's developing or studying or scaling up financing strategies. Certainly in implementation and dissemination science, there seems to be a broad consensus that this is a really important topic, but not a lot of us who are specifically studying it. And I would love to grow the tent of people who are doing that work. And hopefully a presentation like this could be an opportunity to connect to more folks who are interested in doing that. So just want to say, to go back to the equity piece at the beginning, that my perspective on all of this and why I do this work, it's certainly not because I care about money. It's because, like I said before, I view implementation as real work. It adds value. It's often rendered invisible the way that systems operate now. And I would say that organizations and systems are rewarded or incentivized for not compensating implementation because, like I said, people are choosing to do the work anyways. It just, I think, tends to be people who have marginalized identities and are either used to doing thankless work or they're doing it on behalf of their community, even though they know that it's not fair that they're not getting compensated for this. So all of this is really good for bottom lines, but I see it as inequitable at best and exploitative at worst. And I think it also holds us back from improving service quality for recipients and communities of the services that we're providing. So that's why I care about this. That's why I do this work. You know, that's how I ended up a clinical psychologist that studies how we pay for things, is because I really do see it as connected back to what is it that we're valuing and what does it tell us about our values that we haven't found better ways yet to equitably and sustainably support people who are using these complex and costly EBPs that we think are so great. So this is the reference slide. So you'll be able to download that and you can contact me. I do still have a professional Twitter, so you can follow me there. I don't tweet a ton these days, but I am still hanging around, and you can also email me and I'll see if we have any more questions for right now.
We do. We have some questions coming in. So somebody said, I really enjoyed your talk, Dr. Dopp. Have you gotten any feedback from organizations like SAMHSA about whether they'll change how they're doing grants based on your findings?
So it's funny that you would ask that, because we were just talking in a meeting this morning about having a follow-up conversation with SAMHSA. One of the things that we've done with the findings from that REACH study is we created a one-page research brief, and we recruited people from a variety of state and federal organizations, including but certainly not limited to SAMHSA, to get their feedback on our findings and what the policy implications of those findings were. And so what we want to do now is incorporate those policymaker perspectives into the research brief and take it back to organizations like SAMHSA. And at that point, I think we would learn a lot more from them about whether they see opportunities to make changes. I will say that I don't think it was a surprise to anyone at SAMHSA. You know, they had already ended this state-focused grant mechanism before we started studying it. So for that specific model, they didn't necessarily see it as something that they would sustain. But a lot of people in the focus groups talked about really wanting a model that sort of took the best of both worlds from the organization and state-focused mechanisms. So they were sort of dreaming a lot bigger than the options that we put in front of them when we said we compared these two strategies. So we're going to be really curious to see what folks make of that. And that can include SAMHSA, but also more broadly, you know, I certainly won't speak for SAMHSA, but based on our conversations with them so far, I think they would be interested in another meeting to hear more about this. So keep your fingers crossed for us that those lead to productive conversations.
Great, thanks. And it sounds like a really valuable tool. And you've clearly done a lot of work to sort of cater it to this context. Do you have any advice for those, say, outside of youth mental health or with other types of interventions who want to develop similar type of tool?
For fiscal mapping, I assume.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, so that's one of the goals for the next phase is actually to develop a generalizable adaptation process for the tool and have it really well documented to say, here's the stuff that you need to change. Here's what you should take out. Here's what you should add. I will say, again, based on what people told us in pilot testing, I think you could take the tool as it exists right now on the website and use it in another context. And really what you would have to do is be providing support or resources outside of the tool that are specific to whatever context or intervention that you're working on, and maybe just tell people like, yeah, there's some stuff in there about youth mental health. So just like take those examples and resources with a grain of salt. But people told us that they were going to take the tool and use it for something else. And they didn't ask us to adapt it for them. They just said that they were going to go do it. So once they had kind of internalized the process, they saw it as really generalizable, because the fiscal map itself doesn't say anything about the treatment model. It's just guiding you through the five steps. It's really more the resources and the examples and things like that where it gets model specific.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And I had a question just about the sort of coaching that and sort of what went on with the coaching and any, how catered was that to this context? And just generally more about that.
Well, the coaching is a big piece that we saw, like Mary Lou and I would joke all the time about, we're not a scalable solution. So that was something we did for the pilot test, because we recognized this is a new tool. We're building it together. Like, we need to be down there in the weeds with people. But that's why we're turning towards venues like learning collaboratives, where people already have a trusted source of information about the EBP, to sort of just say, hey, here's another tool who can help us along the process. And we're sort of looking for what large scale research funding we might be able to secure to really do this in a big way. But we are doing some smaller scale projects in the meantime to move this forward in a couple of different contexts. So we're starting to get a handle of what that could look like to sort of give this away and just embed it. Because it really was meant to be as pragmatic as possible. The people who stuck with coaching, I will say, they usually wanted a little bit more of your time than 15 minutes. The average coaching session was more like 20, and there was no organization that averaged less than 15. They sort of wanted 20. So some of them wanted more. I coached one organization where the average was like 40-something minutes per session. Because that's what they wanted, and they found it valuable and they had the time. And it was kind of like, if you didn't want 15 to 20 minutes, then the next step down was zero. You know, those were the people that fired us. And again, you know, we were learning what the use case was. So we had some people pilot it who it turned out to really not be a good fit. You know, we're seeing in the future that those coaching tasks could be things that other people could take on. And it was actually really helpful to hear from the existing EBP trainers who were part of our sample, because I thought they would say, no way, we're already so busy, you can't add another thing to our list of things to do during training. But they actually said, well, we get asked so much about this anyways, to actually be able to give people something concrete and work on it with them, instead of kind of like more general advice, actually like feels more productive. So they were actually, at least the people on our sample, were, you know, very open to doing that. So I found that encouraging. And that's why we're heading in that direction for coaching.
Great. Thank you. And one more question. Just, you'd mentioned outcomes tracking. Curious about how you land on which outcomes to track, what types of outcomes they were?
Yeah, that's a whole, you know, there's so many implementation outcomes that you can look at. So I will say for the first study that I mentioned, we really went with like, what could we see in the documentation from SAMHSA about what they were trying to do with these state-focused grants, and what are the outcomes that seem the most relevant? There are other outcomes that were sort of held constant across the two interventions. So like fidelity, for example, because of the certification process that Chestnut Health Systems has developed for ACRA, there was no difference in fidelity outcomes between the grant types. And that was something we looked at because NIDA reviewers wanted us to, but it's sort of baked into the certification process, right? You can't get certified if you don't reach fidelity. So everybody who did get certified had comparable fidelity, but that's kind of almost a tautology to look at that. But again, that kind of shows you that a lot of these implementation outcomes are quite interrelated, because certainly the people who didn't get certified were having worse fidelity. But we looked at it in terms of reach because we really wanted to understand how broadly is this intervention getting out there. And we're wanting to look at, too, in terms of just the sheer number of clinicians who are certified in a state, like how does that relate to the number of youth with substance use problems in that state? Like how many certified ACRA providers are you getting per 1,000 youth or million youth or something like that? So we haven't gone down that road yet. But that again was really sort of driven by what SAMHSA was trying to do with these grants. The fiscal mapping process, the reason we focus on sustainment so much is because the original idea for the project came from qualitative work on sustainment processes and experiences with a different EBP model. And people talked so much about how challenging it was to cobble all of these different funding sources together to keep their program going. So we really thought, if this is such a major sustainment challenge, if we could develop a tool that would help navigate that and make that easier, then that's what we would want to do, is focus on that sustainment piece. Although we are really curious about what the added value would be to introduce the fiscal mapping process earlier during implementation, as opposed to what we did in the pilot study, which is find people who had already implemented and were already in the sustainment phase and then work with them. But it could add value with other implementation outcomes earlier in the process, too. We just haven't studied that yet, because it all comes back to, like, who am I hearing from? Who are we as the team hearing from out in the community who we're partnering with, who are saying that this is important, and why did they care about it? And then I sort of put the implementation outcome lexicon on top of that.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. I see we're almost at the top of the hour, but it was a really great presentation. And I guess people can, looks like, probably email you at this address if they have any
absolutely
questions. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So we covered all the questions.
Yes. Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, if anyone thinks of anything else, yes, feel free to reach out to me. And I'm glad that we did well on time there.
Awesome. Thank you.
Take care, everybody.
Thanks, Dr. Staub and Jacobs. Attendees, when I close the webinar momentarily, a short survey will pop up. Please take a few moments to provide answers to those questions. With that, I'll just close. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for organizing this.